John Pregler, and the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Hello and welcome. Thank you, everybody. My name's John Pregler. I work at Cartograph, a software company here in Dubuque that helps cities, counties, states manage our nation's roads, bridges, drinking water, and wastewater networks. We have over 1,000 clients across the United States, from big cities to rural communities to state DOTs. We help them manage infrastructure that over 80 million Americans use every single day. Strong infrastructure means a strong economy. It means our businesses can compete with anyone in the world. It means people are protected and families can count on safe water, efficient sewer systems, and dependable transportation. And it means good-paying middle-class American jobs.
All right.
Cartograph relies on talented college students who excel in science, math, engineering, and technology, which is why we support the administration's effort to hire more math and science teachers and to make college more affordable and accessible to all Americans. We rely on skilled workers with 2 or 4 year degrees, folks who have gone to higher education at places like Dubuque's Clark University or Northeast Iowa Community College, thank you, to get the training they need for jobs our economy needs and that Cartograph needs here in Dubuque. This administration has made historic investments in community colleges as a gateway to jobs in the middle class. And I know this is close to Dr. Jill Biden's heart. She's been a community college teacher since 1993, and she still teaches today. That's right. Over the last 5 years, Cartograph has grown from 50 to 100 full-time employees because of programs for education at Northeast Iowa Community College and other initiatives the Obama administration has implemented. Our growth shows that even as states face tighter budgets, there is still a high demand for making sure we invest in America's future. President Obama and Vice President Biden know these investments are important. They are urging Congress to pass a transportation bill before it expires this weekend. America needs it. It means job security for middle-class workers who are ready to rebuild our roads and highways. I know this because I see it firsthand in my daily work with our clients all across the United States. We stand behind them because they have given Congress a jobs bill that will put 1 million construction workers, teachers, police officers, and firefighters back to work immediately. President Obama and Vice President Biden know that if we fail to invest in these Americans, we fail to invest in the future of our middle class here in Iowa and across the United States. And for me, this election is about moving forward with a vision for an economy built to last, built on infrastructure, built from the middle out and not from the top down. And our vice president understands that. And you can always count on him to stand up for you and your family, for the middle class, and for our country. And that is why I am proud to introduce to you the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Thank you all. Thank you all. In front of all the press, I want to announce my support for Pregler for office. I tell you, that was good. He just made my speech. I think we can all go home. Thank you so very much, John. I appreciate it very, very much. Hey, folks, it's good to be back in Dubuque. I feel like I'm home. I've kidded myself all these years. I convinced myself y'all love me. And, you know, that's why I like coming back out. It's so great to see so many familiar faces. And you've done so much for the city, so much for the state. And you've done so much, many of you, for me personally. And I just want to tell you how much I appreciate it. My whole family appreciates it. You know, I couldn't help. I was talking to Terry, one of my best buddies in the world, Terry Goodman. We walked out here, looked out at the scene, and I remember when this was first built, Terry asked me to come out as a senator and take a look, and And standing here looking at this magnificent background, my Lord, what a difference a couple decades made. I remember when I first came here. I came here with a guy named Dick Clark, who got elected United States Senate in 1972 with me. And we were in Dubuque jointly doing a fundraiser up on the hill on a bluff for, I forget whose home it was, for Congressman John Culver running for the United States Senate. And I remember later in that decade, I remember how tough things were here in Dubuque. And I remember that those T-shirts saying, "Last one out of Dubuque, turn out the lights." Well, you have lit up the world, man. I tell you, what a difference. What a difference you guys have made. I tell you what. I mean, it really is kind of a story of the grit and determination of the American people, the grit and determination of the heartland. I mean, think of how far all that you have done. You know, I saw the signs on the way here that are totally different signs as I came over from Waterloo. It said, "Masterpiece on the Mississippi." That's what you've turned it into. You've not only turned the lights on, but this is the masterpiece of the Mississippi. And the question, and folks, you know, and that's because of an awful lot of people here, including, Terry and Pam Yoakum. Pam, you here somewhere? I haven't seen you in a while, Pam. Or where is she? I love you, kid. And Tom Hancock and Chuck and Tom Schuller. You've done a remarkable job, all of you. You really have. You really have done a remarkable job. Kind of sort of funny, isn't it, that you got the governor and the Republican nominee fighting about whether I was doing well or not? Okay, now that's kind of fascinating. Anyway, that's another story. look, the question of this election is, can we turn more towns and cities in the heartlands into the masterpiece you all have done? You know, President Obama, when we came to office, we came with a commitment, a genuine commitment to restore America's heartland and America's middle class to the prosperity it once knew and you're beginning to feel again here along the Mississippi, to strengthen rural America so that young people would not have to leave their hometowns and find opportunity. How many of you, I could go through this room and I'll bet you I could name 50 of you, who over the years have said to me, one of your greatest laments was, I remember back in the 70s and 80s, "Joe, my kid just graduated from the University of Iowa, or graduated from Clark College, or graduated. There's no jobs. They got to leave. We got one of the best education systems in the country right here in Iowa. We educate them, and they go. There's nothing here." What this is all about, what you've done, what we're about, is how do you allow your children to have the opportunity you had and come back home and sink their own roots and stay here. That's been a lament in the heartland for the last 35 years, and it's beginning to change. So when we got elected, we went to work. We went to work in two ways. First, the first thing we know, agriculture starts a virtuous cycle. When we're selling more products abroad, when more markets are opened, when more American products, agriculture costs are able to be sold, it starts a virtuous cycle. It means you got to build more machinery. It means you got John Deere has to do more. It means you have to do more high-tech manufacturing. That creates big, good jobs. Manufacturing jobs are about 25 to 40% pay more than all other jobs. So what's happening? Deere's back, not only here in Waterloo, all across America. Deere's back. A lot of other manufacturing's back. The second thing we did was we were absolutely committed to change for this beautiful young woman's generation. A word that her mom and I and others, we didn't hear in the 70s, in the 80s. Mom went around the 70s, but the 80s and the 90s. And that was, we never heard the word insourcing. All we heard was outsourcing. How many times did some of you union guys stand in front of a plant gate with me that was literally padlocked, a padlocked plant gate, because someone got a tax break for literally unbolting the machinery from the floor, putting it on a boat or a plane, and shipping it overseas, where they could make, like a trail, just outside of Waterloo. Hundreds of employees, I think 250, unbolted, moved to Tijuana, $1.50 an hour, selling products back here to the people who don't have jobs, who used to make that product. So we wanted to change it. from outsourcing to insourcing. Look, ladies and gentlemen, America is on the verge, on the move. We are better positioned than any nation in the world to lead the world's economy. We still have the largest economy in all the world. We're still well over twice as big as China. We, our per capita GDP is 10 times as big as China. We should be promoting everything possible to let us compete with the world. We have the most productive workers in the world. And but so what did we do? Literally, not figuratively. We bet on the productivity of the American worker. We just had this big outsourcing conference, insourcing conference at the White House. Some of the largest companies in America came to see us, from Ford Motor Company, the DuPont Company, came in to see the president and me. And they said, basically, we're coming home. You know why they're coming home? Not just because wages have gone up in China and all these other places they went to. Not just because the cost of transportation has skyrocketed. Not just because they can't protect their intellectual property in those countries. They can't here. Not because they don't have a reliable court system there, and they don't. We have one here. Do you know what the bottom line was? The Boston Consultative Group did this study. American workers are 3 times as productive as Chinese workers. 3 times. Crazy. So that means even if you paid the American worker twice as much, you get a bigger bang for the buck at being made in the United States of America. So they're coming home. They're coming home. John pointed out 600,000 high-tech manufacturing jobs in the United States of America today that don't have people to fill the jobs. Why? Because our generation, what happened? All those tool and die makers we used to have, they got shipped overseas. They shipped overseas, those jobs. And what happened? When your son says, I want to be a tool and die maker, no, there's no jobs for that, man. We're short tens of thousands of tool and die makers. To give you one example, that's where the community colleges come in. My wife, Jill, will not let the president or me ever forget any week about community colleges. You think I'm joking? I'm not joking. She says they are the best kept secret in the United States of America. But what they're doing now, there's kind of a conveyor belt. We set up this program, the president did, where you go to a community college, you're a high-tech manufacturer, you need people in the community, you don't have the workforce you need, and you're able to walk into the community college and say, look, we'll give you some of our specialists to come in and set up a program. Train your students. Give them a certificate. And we'll have a conveyor belt. We'll take them right from community college and we'll hire them. Dow Cocoa, I can take you all over America in this state as well. It's working. It's working. It's about concentrating on American workers. You know, Governor Romney says his experience as a businessman. No. I'm going to try to be as. No. I'm going to try to be as objective as it is possible. I know I can't be objective. I'm the other team. But I'm going to try to say this as straight as I can. Because I think, by the way, this is a decent man. I think this guy's a patriotic American. He just has a different value set than we do. He just has a different sense of what's going to make America better. I mean, it's just a fundamentally different value set. But he's a decent, honorable man. And he always talks about his being a businessman. Excuse me for my cold. And he said being a businessman is what gives him a great understanding, and I'm paraphrasing it, what it takes to bring back jobs to the United States. Now, but like so many other things the governor says, he talks about, there's a huge disconnect between what he says and what he means and what he's done. Now, don't take my word for it. Just last week, the Washington Post did what was described as an extensive examination, not of what Romney said, but of what Romney, when he was head at Bain Capital, there's a requirement, and a lot of you people know this, there's the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. So when you engage in certain business practices, you have to, totally legitimate, you have to file with the SEC saying what your purpose is, what you're doing. And so they went back and looked at all these filings that Bain Capital and the companies they own file with the SEC. And here's what the Washington Post article said, and I'm quoting. During nearly 15 years that Romney was actively involved in running Bain, continuing to quote, a private equity firm that he founded, it, meaning Bain, owned companies that were pioneers in the practice of shipping work from the United States to overseas call centers and factories, end of quote. Now, after days of saying nothing in response to our criticism of that policy, the Romney campaign has responded, I think yesterday, by saying, we just don't get it. Saying, we don't understand the difference. Now, I want you to listen closely, because maybe you can understand the difference. Here's what they said. We don't understand the difference between offshoring and outsourcing. Okay. If you're looking for work, that's a pretty cruel joke. I can picture one guy in my old neighborhood standing next to another guy in an employment line and saying, hey, John, did you get offshored or outsourced? Which happened to you? Do you think it matters to the American worker? Do you think it matters to the community? Either way, Romney helped, and by his response acknowledged that he helped his campaign, helped take companies, take work that was being done in the United States or could have been done in the United States and sent it overseas, off American shore. Look, Mitt Romney's been saying from the very beginning, and it's a logical thing, a logical riff for him to use. And I'm a businessman, I'm a job creator. Well, I was saying he didn't create many jobs, but it turns out I was wrong. You got to give him credit. He created a hell of a lot of jobs in Singapore, China, India. He has done a pretty good job. But the problem is, the guys in my old neighborhood don't live in Singapore. They don't live in China. They don't get their income from there to send their kids to try to send them to college or help care for their sick parent. Look, now some of Romney's defenders say, and it's not illegitimate, they say, Biden, you're being unfair. That was his job at Bain. And in truth, it was his job at Bain, to make money for his shareholders, to make money for the companies they took over, make money for his company. That was his job. Well, that's what he was supposed to do, they say. But then they take a look when he became governor of Massachusetts. What we saw is that it wasn't just his job, it was his philosophy of government, his economic philosophy. Two examples. As governor of Massachusetts, his administration, the Romney administration, signed a $160,000 a month contract paid to people abroad to help poor people in Massachusetts get food stamps. So when a Massachusetts legislature passed a bill saying you can't outsource, or offshore, whatever he calls it, you can't outsource state contracts overseas, he vetoed the bill. So here is the cruel irony. You're unemployed in Massachusetts when he was there. You're an unemployed worker. You pick up the phone to call the state of Massachusetts line. A woman picks up, she lost her job, picks up the phone to call the state of Massachusetts about her unemployment benefits. And she ends up talking to someone in another country who has a job she could be doing and not having to seek unemployment. I mean, say it again. I know it sounds so crazy, but that's literal. Literally. I mean, even if it made the state money, how can you do that? You're calling overseas with the tax dollars you made when you were working to find out about getting help for a job you lost through no fault of your own, and somebody else answers the phone that you could be doing the same job back in Massachusetts and answering the phone. And by the way, all this outsourcing or offshoring or whatever it is, whatever they want to call it, it has another effect. It puts downward pressure on everybody else's wages who has a job. Look, folks, God love the unemployed are really in trouble. My grandpa used to say from Scranton, he said, Joey, when the guy in Dunmore, the next town over, when the guy in Dunmore is out of work, it's an economic slowdown. When your brother-in-law is out of work, it's a recession. When you're out of work, it's a depression. It's a depression for millions and millions of Americans. It's a depression. Ladies and gentlemen, so even people, though, who have jobs are discontent. How many of you have had your wages stagnant for the last 4, 5, 6, 7 years? Almost all. That is hard, man. If you're leaving middle-class life, that's hard. That's hard. So part of the discontent in America is not just those poor people who are in depression, but people who are working. Don't see any light. Don't see any way it's going to get any better real soon. And outsourcing, offshoring, what it does, it depresses the wages of people who are here, working in American companies here. Look, as I said, I really mean this. I think Romney's a decent guy. But his philosophy is really different. You know, there's those folks out there, and this has been the history of the journey of the country for a long time, who view the American worker as part of the problem. If you just ask for less, if you just work harder, if you just didn't need all those benefits, we could do things better, quicker, faster. You see it played out in Wisconsin. You see it played out in Ohio. You see it played out in all these other races. And I honestly try to think, what is it? What was the core disagreement that we have with Governor Romney? For all the stuff about socialism and capitalism, we're all capitalists. God, you know, the capitalist system has been the greatest economic engine in the history of the world. The history of the world. But what's the difference? Well, I think the basic difference is, I think Governor Romney supporters see American labor. I don't mean just organized labor, particularly the American organized labor, but see American labor as the problem. We see American workers as the solution. Literally. No, literally. That's why, and I'll give you an example why I think that's the case. And you may disagree with me, although you're partisan, I know, but you may disagree on this. Here's what I think. I think that, look, the best example is the automobile industry. One of the first things the president and I did, over the objection, by the way, of a lot of Democrats, was rescue the automobile industry. Everybody's mad at the automobile industry. Even the people who were labor guys weren't auto workers. Even the people who were strong Democrats, the management of automobile companies and all this stuff. Why are we going to bail these guys out? Remember that whole thing? It wasn't overwhelmingly popular. But as the press has reported, I was adamant about not letting this iconic industry go down the drain, an industry that helped build the middle class, an industry that had gone down the drain. We would have lost another million jobs. By the way, I say they would have worked, the market would have worked it through. Come on, give me a break. I was with the chairman of the board of the Ford Motor Company who said to me, and has said publicly, had Chrysler and General Motors gone under, Ford would have gone under because the supply chain would have been dried up. So this stuff about, you know, it would have worked its way out. But what was the core reason why the president believed we should go ahead and take the chance? Because he genuinely believed in the productivity of the American worker. That the American worker, the American automobile worker, could outproduce anybody in the world every time. That was the bet. And he also believed in the ingenuity of American business and management. Give them a chance to reorganize. So what did we do? Our administration administered some very tough medicine. Everybody took a kid, including the auto workers. My state of Delaware, which had the highest percentage, one of the highest percentages of auto workers of any state in the nation other than Michigan, we lost it all. Two biggest plants in the nation, in our state, General Motors and Chrysler have been there for an average of 45 years each. At one time, over 10,000 workers. Gone. Gone. It was tough medicine. They shrunk. They reorganized. But what's happening now? We not only saved a million jobs, since restructuring, industry has added back another 200,000 good-paying, decent jobs. GM is the leading manufacturer in the world of automobiles now. Chrysler is the fastest-growing company. But folks, look, what we did, we kept moving. We kept moving again because we thought we'd give the American worker a chance, just give them a fighting chance, they'll do it. I already talked to you about 600,000 manufacturing jobs that are home here now, tying the skills with the community colleges so they produce the workers we need here because we are the most productive workers. Ladies and gentlemen, we also decided to go out and we invested in renewable energy. One of the best ways... By the way, we have more gas and oil rigs for all the stuff we're anti-gas and we have more gas and oil rigs pumping in the United States today than all the rest of the world combined. We are importing less oil anytime in the last 16 years. And we are, but we think you got to bet on it all. You got to go to alternative energy as well. And so when we talked, when we made, we came up with tax credits. If you build wind turbines, and even if you install them, if you build wind turbines, you get a tax credit. That brought billions of dollars off the sidelines and private investment to invest in these. And you had our good friend Mitt Romney saying, he dismissed wind and solar by saying, two of the most ballyhooed forms of alternative energy. Well, tell that to the 7,000 Iowans who are manufacturing wind power parts here in the state of Iowa, making good, decent wages in an area that's expanding. Ladies and gentlemen, that's why we want to end right now the practice of getting tax breaks to those companies that I referenced earlier who unbuckle stuff off the floor and send it overseas. Instead of getting a tax break for moving, we say, you get a tax break. You unbuckle the machinery that's in China and you bring it home, we'll give you a tax break. That's the place to give you a tax break. Look, folks. Manufacturing is coming back, and it's one of the pillars upon which the middle class is built. It's not the only one. It's one of the pillars. America has to make things again. Make things again. You know all the legendary stuff about how Biden rode Amtrak 67 million times, which I have a lot. You go back and forth to New York on the East Coast, to Washington, New York. You go through Newark, New Jersey, and Trenton, New Jersey, and spur off the Delaware River, and there's an old bridge there, a trestle. And in faded paint, it's peeling, it has written on the bridge, Trenton makes what the world takes. We got to start making what the world takes again. Where is it written that we can't be the leading manufacturing country in the world? Where does it say that? Why can that not? We are convinced and absolutely certain that is possible again. Goes back to the central theme, faith in the productivity and the productivity of the American work and the ingenuity of American business. 495,000 new manufacturing jobs just since 2010. Nearly 20,000 new manufacturing jobs since then right here in the state of Iowa. The fastest growth in manufacturing since 1990. And Romney, when the president talked about this, said he was out of touch. He said the president was out of touch for encouraging young people to look at high-tech manufacturing as alternatives for jobs. Romney calling the president out of touch? I mean, did you ever think that you'd have a choice between voting for a president who had a Swiss bank account and one who didn't? I mean, think about it. I mean, just nothing wrong. I mean, did you ever think you'd have a nominee of a major political party running for president who has significant investments in the Cayman Islands? Talk about faith in the system. Out of touch. Ladies and gentlemen, I really believe this election is going to be the starkest choice in our lifetime. We just have fundamentally different theories of the case. Governor Romney believes that if people at the top do very, very well, and he's not alone, they do very, very well, everybody else will benefit. Everything else will work. The president, I believe, as John said, that the way you go look at the history of the journey of this country, we've always done well when we've built from the middle out. We're not just this hobby horse. I'm not just talking about middle class because that's what I am, where I come from, who I am. It's not one of those deals. It's simple. When the middle class does well, the poor have a shot and hope, and the wealthy do very, very well. Everybody does fine when the middle class is doing well. Everybody. America does fine. So, folks, let me get to it. That's why we have to invest in things that are essential to our future and have always built this country, in our economic growth. We have to invest in education, innovation, research and development, new energy outlets, develop new markets for products we make and be able to sell them abroad. We believe that's the way to deal with this god-awful recession we inherited, that everyone share in responsibility, everyone generate, be part of this generating robust economy. Think about it, folks. Everybody else has sort of paid in on the deal to get us out of this hole they put us in, except one group of people. Everybody. Neighborhood I come from, you don't mind giving, man, when there's a crisis. And this is the tradition of this city and this country and this state. When you got a problem, neighbors get together, everybody chips in, everybody makes a little sacrifice. You don't mind. You don't mind. But I tell you what. In my neighborhood, you don't mind chipping in, but you hate being played for a sucker. You hate being played for a sucker. And right now, people look around and they say, now, I don't quite get this. My wages are stagnant. I understand. I can't ask for more. I understand I don't get this, what I used to get before. I understand my house is upside down through no fault of my own, and I can't refinance it even though I've never missed a mortgage payment. I don't like it. I understand it. I wish I'd get some help, but I get it. And they look around, and Romney in his budget and Ryan offers a plan where they say the way this economy is going to recover, they lay it out. They say not only are you going to keep the top $800 billion tax cut for the very wealthy, you're going to double down, and he's a cost for a new tax cut of $2 trillion over the next 10 years where you have to make a minimum of $1 million to benefit from that $2 trillion. Come on, man. No, I'm serious. I'm serious. These guys are true believers. True believers. People feel like they're being played for a sucker. That's why we require a tax policy that says ordinary Americans don't have to pay higher rate than millionaires. That's not going to balance the budget, but it's going to inject into the deal fairness. Everybody's willing to chip in when everybody else is in the deal. But you can't leave a whole segment of society out. Top 1 and 2% have done exponentially better as middle-class incomes have plummeted over the last decade. But, folks, it's not just about the economy. I could go on about what I think the inequities are out there, but you all feel it in your bones. You know it. It's also about social policy and foreign policy. It's about who we are as Americans. It's about what kind of country we're going to be in the 21st century. All that's at stake. Again, these guys aren't bad guys. They have a very different view, though. Just imagine. I want you to, as old joke when you're a kid in school and your teacher say, close your eyes and think. Close your eyes and picture what the Supreme Court would look like 4 years from now after Romney. No, no, for real. After Romney, you're president for 4 years. Tell me what you think are going to happen to women's rights in this country. Civil rights. Right. Ladies and gentlemen, impact on our foreign policy. Just imagine. Imagine if we just follow what Romney had said the last 4 years. My guess is, well, I take him at his word, we still have 20,000 or more troops in Iraq. The proudest thing I ever did was the president putting me in charge of Iraq policy, being able to stand on the last day, stand in a salute, General Austin, and say, Americans, go home, like all Americans have, with nothing but your pride and your honor. I was proud my son. I was proud my son served this year. I was prouder. I was prouder. And they did their job and they came home. He says we shouldn't have. We should still have troops there. He said the president made a mistake convincing 49 other nations that it's time to turn over responsibility to the Afghans, the longest war in American history. He said we should not have done that. We should stay there. Ladies and gentlemen, he talks about we have a bad policy in Iran. Only thing we're not doing is bombing Iran. Is that what he's talking about? He should say so, if that's what he means. There's stark difference. This is the guy who said he wouldn't support it, the New START treaty with Russia, when every major Republican foreign policy expert, every former Secretary of State and Defense, but one in the Republican administration, came and said this is essential. He says Russia is our most serious geopolitical threat. What would what do you think American foreign policy would look like 4 years from now with Romney as President of the United States of America? Again, not a bad guy, but a totally different view of the world. Look, folks, there's a lot at stake. My problem is I think Romney's social policy is right out of the 50s. Seriously, right out of the 50s. I think his foreign policy is right out of the Cold War. And his economic policy is just doubling down on the 8 years of the last administration that put us in this god-awful mess in the first place. I honest to God believe that is the fundamental difference between us. Our policy, a policy that gives everyone a fair shot, a fair shake, demands responsibility from poor folks, middle-class folks, and from wealthy folks, and moves us forward together. That's how we've always done this. Look, folks, we need to choose between a commander who should be commander-in-chief, not outsourcer-in-chief. We need someone who creates jobs in Davenport and Dubuque and Pittsburgh, Toledo, not Singapore, South Korea and Shanghai. We need someone, whether you disagree with them or not, who has a backbone like a ramrod and the convictions of his beliefs, who demonstrates that he can make hard choices, do the right things, the conviction of his character. As the president has said, this is a make-or-break moment for the middle class. He knows. The middle class isn't just a number. You know it's not a number. I love these other guys. They talk about us like we're a number. Was it $49,270 or $52,719? What's the definition of middle class? The middle class is a value set. Middle class is a way of life. The middle class is about being able to own your home, not just rent it. Middle class is being able to live in a safe town, a safe neighborhood, where your kids can walk to a park. Middle class is about being able to send your kid to a school, a primary school, that if they do well, they can qualify to go to a university. Do you know anybody, rich, poor, or middle class, that doesn't dream of their kid going to college? Have you found somebody yet who doesn't have that hope for their kids? Ladies and gentlemen, what it comes down to, middle class means being able to raise your kid in your neighborhood, your city, your state, and then be able to come home and live a life better than you even lived in that neighborhood. To put down their own roots, about being able to dream that your child can become whatever they aspire to be. I got criticized, which is legitimate, I got criticized a couple months ago because I got very angry. And it just showed on my face when the implication was made by folks on the other side that somehow we middle class, we have wealth envy. Remember that? We have wealth envy. That's what we're about. Biden's about wealth envy. Let me tell you something, man. They don't understand where we all come from. My mom and dad weren't poor. Barack makes me sound like I climbed out of a coal mine in Scranton with a lunch bucket. And I didn't, you know. No one in my family worked in a factory. That's not a good or bad thing. No, there were white-collar workers who were just never, you know, we just three-bedroom, split-level house, four kids, and a relative permanently living with us all the time. You know, normal. No, really, that was normal where I was from, okay? Like a normal for y'all. It bothers me when some of these critics and editorial writers talk about us like somehow we're just kind of pedestrian, that we don't dream. My mother never had a doubt that if I wanted to be president or vice president, my brother wanted to be a millionaire, my sister wanted to run a great institution, that we couldn't do that. Never, never, never in her life, nor did my father. Their aspirations for us were unlimited. Aspirations aren't limited to people with money. They're aspirations we have. But you gotta have like a minimum place from which to start in the middle class, for people to believe it's possible. That's what feeds the dreams, what feeds the innovation, what feeds the progress in this country. It's basically about being able to turn to your child and say, when they got a problem, and say, honey, it's going to be okay. It's almost that basic. Just say, honey, it's going to be okay, and believe it's going to be okay. You know, I think the longest walk any man or woman can make is up a short flight of stairs to the kid's bedroom. To say, honey, I'm sorry. Daddy lost his job. Or mommy lost her job. We're not going to live here anymore, honey. Or daddy, mommy, we didn't have enough money to pay the bank, honey. And we have to move. We have to move. You can't go to St. John's next semester, or you can't go to Cooper School, or your little league team, honey. There's other good little league teams. My dad made that walk when I was in third grade. I remember walking up, we were living with my grandpa Finnegan after, it was in the 1953-54, and it was after the war, and Scranton was on the balls of its heels, like Dubuque was back in 20 years ago. He had a job, but it wasn't a good enough job. My dad was, some of you met my dad over the years, a proud, decent, honorable gentleman, graceful man. And he walked up, sat in the end of the bed, and I remember it specifically. It wasn't a trauma, I just remember. He said, Joey, Daddy's going to have to move. I'm going to move down to Wilmington, Delaware with Uncle Frank. There's good jobs down there, honey. And I'll be down there about a year. I promise I'll come home every weekend if I can. It's only 157 miles, I'm saying. And I thought, that's the moon. And he said, I'll come home every weekend. And it turned out he did, as I remember it. He said, but, you know, there's good jobs. When Daddy gets a job, I'm going to bring you, Mom, and Valerie and Jimmy, and my mom was then pregnant with Brother Frankie, down. And things are going to be good. It's going to be okay, honey. I believed him because he said it, but I knew I was going to move, couldn't go to the same school. It wasn't until I got to be in my 30s, and this is what I don't think these guys understand, until I got in my late 20s, early 30s, that maybe the more difficult walk my dad had to make was into my grandfather Ambrose Finnegan's pantry. In front of my mother's brothers and say, Ambrose, I need a favor. Can you take care of Gene and the kids? It'll be about a year. I promise you. I promise you I'll make good. I promise you. Too many Americans have made that walk. Too many Americans have made that walk. And ladies and gentlemen, my dad used to say it. A job's about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about your respect. It's about your place in your community. These other guys aren't bad guys, but I don't think they get it. I don't think they get what it is. Too many people have been stripped of their dignity. And folks, that's what this is all about. When Barack says that this is the defining issue of our time, it's about reestablishing an opportunity. When have the American people ever let the country down when they've been given an even chance, a fair shot? It's never happened. And that takes me back to, and I'll conclude, it's about how much faith we have in the people we grew up with. Ladies and gentlemen, that longest walk is being replaced by another walk. Parents are coming home from John Deere now, walking in and say, honey, it's going to be okay. I got a good job. I'm making a product that not only is here, but the rest of the world wants to buy. I have pride in what I'm doing. Honey, I'm okay. I got a job doing A, B, C. Like John, I got a job that the rest of the country is looking to. Just give us a chance to do our job. Ladies and gentlemen, we've seen 4 million of those better journeys since we've become president, created over 4 million private sector jobs. And the bottom line of all is this, we got a long way to go to dig us out of that god-awful hole we were pushed into. But folks, the question is how to speed up this process. We have no disagreement. We have to do more. But how do you do it? We think this is no time to turn back. Absolutely no time whatsoever to turn back. And again, folks, a lot of you know me since I was a kid in politics, and back in 72, and three, four, five. I got characterized as a 29-year-old kid who got elected to the Senate, who was an idealist and optimistic, and I find it fascinating. You notice in the press, they sometimes refer to Biden as the White House optimist, like I'm the new kid in the block, you know, But I want to conclude by telling you, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, I am more optimistic today about America's prospects than I was when I was a 29-year-old kid. We are better positioned if we do the right thing. We are better positioned to lead the world in the 21st century than we have ever been in the history of this country. It's about letting the energies of the people go. It's about investing in them. It's about giving them a chance. It's about holding everyone responsible. And so, folks, with the grace of God and the goodwill of the neighbors, and my grandpa would say, and the creek not rising, we're not only going to win, America's going to win. Because America's coming back, Dubuque is back, and America's going to come back because of all of you. So thank you. Let's go get them, all right? Thank you all very, very much. God bless you all. May God protect our troops. They're still out there. Thank you.